The Repair Shop is just about the most popular show on New Zealand TV at the moment, as anxious and hopeful owners of heirlooms and keepsakes, all manner of items of great emotional importance, take them, if you've never seen the show, to be restored by experts impressive in their crafts and unfailingly nice and kind to those who entrust them with precious family history. And it seems a no-brainer as a show. How come someone didn't think of it earlier? But that's not what the program makers in the UK thought when it was pitched to them. And it was pitched to them by a Kiwi who liked the idea when she saw it and developed it into what it's become. She is Carla Maria Lawson, a multi-award-winning channel manager and commissioner. She is the BBC's head of daytime and early peak viewing, looking after a lot of shows. Carla Maria was responsible, for example, for refreshing the MasterChef format, leading it to becoming a big hit globally. And she was once a reporter with RNZ. Carla Maria, hello.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you, and lovely to talk to you. You've lived in the UK for how long now?
Well, I'll say 25 years. It's maybe a tad longer than that. They'll be giving my age away, Jim.
What took you there in the first place?
Well, I think it was that I wanted to challenge myself a bit more in terms of work and the type of work. I wanted to be somewhere where there was a vibrant music scene, and I really loved the music here. Lots of different opinions and lots of buzz, and it was really a challenge, and also just culturally, just a bit more breadth.
Speaking of culturally, was it easy to break in as a Kiwi? Because it is actually a surprisingly different culture in some ways, isn't it?
It is. I mean, there are lots of similarities in terms of references. I mean, I think that sets us apart from the Australians, but things that we grew up with, our understanding of things like, you know, Guy Fawkes or EastEnders and Coronation Street, that sort of thing, as compared with some of my Australian colleagues who you know, really kind of struggled with that. But in terms of people at the time that I moved to the UK, at the BBC especially, if they couldn't place you in terms of which university you went to, that set you apart. But then at the same time, being from New Zealand made me largely exempt. I mean, they didn't actually know that I didn't go to university. It occurred to them that such a critic could exist, you know. I'd be given a bit more freedom, if you like, as opposed to, you know, my colleagues who were very much pigeonholed according to, you know, where they'd gone to school.
Yeah, that's interesting. And there's a certain cachet now, actually, isn't there, in not having been to university?
Well, who knew that I would become so fashionable? Yes. And so now, of course, I tell everybody. I don't know if that's the right thing to do in terms of vocational guidance. But, you know, for me, I just, again, you know, leaving school, it was wanting to get out there quickly. I just wanted to experience things. And I think that in that period of time, you gather life experiences that make you, you know, slightly different. You meet all sorts of different people. And, you know, I think that is more valued now. You know, for me, I think it's always been an advantage, but now, you know, it's something that actually I don't feel embarrassed about or feel that I have to hide.
Yeah, that's an interesting sea change and a great one in some respects. You have got a big role with the BBC. So before we get to The Repair Shop, what other shows do you oversee, please?
Well, I'm now the head of daytime and early peak, and I look after live event programming as well for the BBC. But before that, I was a commissioning editor, and I looked after a large number of shows, probably about 30 shows, but in all sorts of different genres, ranging from factual to factual entertainment formats, to entertainment shows such as the Graham Norton Show. And now in my current role, I oversee about 1,500 hours of programming, original programming a year. A lot of heritage brands that, you know, I see when I go home to see my mum in New Zealand, you know. It's interesting how many of my shows are on telly there, and sometimes kind of at about the same time. It's sometimes a little bit disconcerting, you know, when I'm home and escape to the country, and I think, gosh, you know, she has no intention of buying a watermill in Herefordshire, but still. work for some reason.
It'd be like coming home to an alternative universe, but quite familiar at the same time.
Yes.
That is a lot to be across. I have to ask you if your New Zealand training, if your Radio New Zealand training actually was of any use in all of this.
Do you know, Radio New Zealand was fantastic in those days. I was very lucky to work with a really talented bunch of journalists and a fantastic chief reporter. There was a real journalistic rigour then, and I attribute a lot of my ability to be able to cope in the radio newsroom at the BBC when I went there to that quite traditional training, I suppose, that I got in the radio newsroom in Radio New Zealand.
I suppose being a New Zealander has always had a certain type of currency in the UK, but you weren't planning on being a nanny or a barista. You had something in your sights.
Well, I'd had a good career in New Zealand and I kind of thought I would be going back. But, you know, I worked, I had some great jobs in New Zealand. I was chief reporter at Radio New Zealand. I worked with Paul Holmes and people like that. And, you know, it was a buzzy place to work. And, you know, I worked at 1ZM. I did news reading there. So it was great fun. But I just wanted to be a small fish in a big pond, if that makes sense, and experience the kinds of challenges that I could have here in the UK, particularly in the London market.
We're talking with Carla Maria Lawson, and you became a big fish, actually, in a big pond. You, in all sorts of ways, you've now met many famous people. And I read that there was an evening with Joni Mitchell once. There's so much buzz at the moment around the 50th anniversary of her album Blue. I read that you spent an evening with her and that she was fantastically indiscreet. And I was curious about what she was indiscreet about.
Well, to be honest, it was largely about her personal life, which was quietly, for somebody as young as I was at the time, slightly disarming. But she was completely captivating, and she was such good company. You know, I don't really feel I should say what she the conversation, but it was. But she was just incredibly. Oh, what's the word for it? She had an aura about her. She really did. And she was also quite naughty and funny.
I want to go on to the repair shops, but I know you've met all sorts, George Harrison, Stevie Wonder, Prince Charles. So well done on those meetings. But the repair shop, well done on that. It is just as huge here as it is in the UK. Before I ask you a few questions about it, can you give us an idea of its popularity in Britain?
Yes, it is now probably the biggest factual show on British television outside of the news. It gets audiences of between 5 and 6 million viewers for original episodes that are going out. So I think the audience values it for being something quite different, I think, in the schedules at a time when I think people need that sense of positivity and recognition of people doing something lovely. It features people doing something for little reward, you know, there's no monetary reveal, which was, you know, was a big USP of the show. But it also features people who are really fantastic at what they do. And they absolutely love being together and sharing their knowledge.
I know that is part of its deep charm. USP meaning unique selling point, yeah? Just to translate
sorry,
that.
Yes, unique selling point.
You must be so proud of it. What a thrill to have it succeed so well.
Oh, well, I am. Thank you. It's a real, it's my baby, really, my television baby. When I was a commissioner, it was really hard to get it commissioned because, as I say, there was a sense of why would anybody watch something that didn't have a monetary reveal at the end of it? And it's quite difficult to persuade people that the emotional currency in itself could pack enough of a punch. But it was just something I kind of felt viscerally could work. And the company kept saying, oh, well, we give up. And it's like, no, please don't. I'm sure we can make this work. Just put more welding in the taster tape, you know. Lots of sparks. That'll do it.
That's quite funny. But it's pitched so well. You see, I presume all flattery aside, and this is presumably where your talents come in, it's pitched well, the right presenters, the right people with heirlooms. And I wonder, is that an audition? You must have an auditioning process. So that is pretty precise, I'm thinking.
So before I took it to the controller to pitch it, I wanted to have the cast assembled in terms of the experts. And I wanted people that had not been on television before in that territory. I didn't want the same faces that you see in antique shows, you know, because frankly, sometimes it can resemble a bit of a Carry On movie when you've got the same kind of same group of experts on all of these shows. And I thought, I want people that you can look at and go, oh, that's a bit like me. You know, it doesn't have to be all white men of a certain age. And so we assembled this cast of experts who I felt could talk to a really broad audience, because I wanted it to also appeal to a younger audience. Because another of my bugbears is the fact that people assume that there's no way that you can reach a younger audience in television anymore. And I think there's a lot of embarrassing dad dancing that goes on in terms of trying to appeal to a younger audience. Whereas I wanted a show where I felt that a young audience would come to a territory like this because it was just good telly and it was inclusive and they could see themselves on television. And so, yes, casting is absolutely critical to that. Getting the experts in place was the first thing. And then it was about the atmosphere, because I think the other big character in the show is the barn itself. And I had a really clear idea in my head of what it would look like, and about the kind of sense of industry that I wanted to convey, and, you know, the sense of endeavor and busyness. And so finding a space that represented old, new, and could accommodate that kind of level of activity was quite difficult. And then there's the casting of the contributors and the items, which I look at every item. It's every item is sent to me as a page with a description of the item itself, what the backstory is, and what likely repairs could be done. And we pair it up with an expert. And so, you know, and then we make sure that the mix in each of the episodes is varied. So it could be quite mawkish if you put, you know, clustered together items that were all about a deep sense of, you know, connection with somebody recently bereaved, yeah, for instance. So you do have to really mix it up for tone. You need joy in it as well. And there are all sorts of reasons people bring things into the barn. But I think the thing that generally binds all of the items together is this sense of modesty. I don't think anything is really worth loads of money, you know. And if it is, it's unintentional. It's there because of its emotional value to the contributors. But having said all of that, we don't cast it for tears either. You know, I didn't know when I was embarking on this process that a piano stall could make somebody burst into tears. You know, we didn't know what it was going to do in terms of how powerful it could be emotionally. I thought at the very least, though, it was going to be interesting.
I think there are tears. I think there are a lot of tears in a very good way when people watch the repair shop, because the emotions are so genuine. All right, so it took you a while to get it green lit. People were saying, oh, are you sure? There must have been a part of you worried that it might flop. Not that you thought it would, but I imagine your judgment was on the line here.
Oh, yes, but I think that you don't do my job without that being part of the deal for everything. If you knew how to make a hit, then you'd be very rich indeed. You know, it's not a precise science. You can't always know. There are certain things that, you know, I've hoped would work and haven't taken off. There's shows that I'm commissioning now that I, you know, is in my role now as the person who green lights these things. You know, I've just commissioned a competitive walking format. I think it'll work, but who knows? It's called Take a Hike. Maybe they'll ask me to do that. But no, you can't always know. And you've just got to be brave and go with it if you think. I mean, I had probably the best indication that would be that it would work, and that was the gold stamp from my mother, who is the best barometer in my view of what could be a hit. Because I was watching the rough cuts in New Zealand, because pre COVID I'd come home every year for about a month or more, and I was looking at the rough cuts, and I heard a little scrape behind me. It was my mum pulling her chair up and looking over my shoulder. So I thought, yeah, no, I think this will work.
There is something about New Zealand in the show. I'm not saying it's exclusively New Zealand. I'm sure it's present in the UK as well. But it's about simple joys and the magnificence, actually, of unassuming people with great skills.
No, I think that that's spot on. And that's part of what I saw in it as well, is like this, I think something that I feel is intrinsic in Kiwi culture about, you know, just getting on and doing things, and also being interested in things, a lovely fascination and curiosity about people and about items, and a preparedness to fix things. You know, I just think that that's very much part of the Kiwi can do nature of things, as is, I think, the sense of modesty and appreciating things that are humble.
Carla Maria Lawson is talking to us on Sunday morning. Are there inanimate objects in your life, you know, whether it's a sewing machine or an accordion or a teddy bear, that all of which needed repairing in the last episode I saw, I think, that you would be bereft without? Do you have any items that you might take to a repair shop?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. One that I would have loved to have had repaired if it was still with me was a koala bear that I had as a child, which was left with a hungry Labrador when I was taken to hospital with tonsillitis, and I came out, it wasn't the same ever again.
Gosh, you know, the power of memory and the attachment of things to those memories, it is such a force.
It is, because particularly it's interesting with the dolls that come in, or the toys, and, you know, because those items that have been, that people have clutched to them at times of grief, or they grew up with, they bring out this extraordinary rawness, I suppose, of emotion, however many years down the line. I mean, we had one of the earlier series, I think it was the first Christmas series that we did, Christmas episode that we did, and it was a woman who was an evacuee, and she had a doll, Betty doll, I remember her name was, and she was 5 years old, and it was the first Christmas present she'd ever had, and it was her first Christmas away from home as an evacuee, and having Betty doll given back to her, actually it makes me feel a bit choked up thinking about it, you know, it's just, and it could have been yesterday for her, you know. Those items particularly strike a chord, I've noticed. And then we had a lovely one in a recent before last Christmas special with two middle-aged men, and their delight at having their chopper bike restored, and they were 11 again, you know.
Yeah, I know, and it's all on show, you know. The when it came in rough form across your desk, the revivification of some of these things can be like restoring people to life sometimes, themselves, as you're saying, because of their attachment with the past. When it came across your desk, I'm interested in whether you saw all this from the get-go. Did the possibilities instantly jump into your head?
Yes, the reason being, I mean, I'm pitched things in this territory, hundreds of things like this all the time. But what's leapt out the page for me was actually the tagline, which said "The Workshop of Dreams," and that just immediately conjured up in my mind this magical space. The barn is one of the key characters in the series. You know, the possibilities of dreams being restored, and, you know, magic being worked. And it had a glow about it that separated it from anything else I'd been pitched. I'd actually been pitched another idea with exactly the same name, only maybe 6 months previously, which, you know, of course, is always in my job quite, you have to be very clear about why you've not commissioned one thing and you've commissioned the other. But, you know, this had very distinct points of difference, which were about that, you know, that very emotional sense of space and the possibilities of things being, you know, revived and what it might mean for people.
And it's a lovely, honest oasis as well, if you look at it, you know, on a more macro level. It's a lovely oasis in a difficult world, isn't it, when you watch this show?
Well, it's interesting that the experts themselves find it an oasis because, you know, they're all in their real lives work in isolation, doing what they do. And, you know, they are just so excited to be in this space together. And they, you know, they're all in their own jobs, puzzle solvers, but they're used to doing it on their own. And so they are really gleeful when they come together. They, I mean, they genuinely, they get on really well. They just love trading ideas and tips. And, you know, Kirsten, who's the ceramics restorer, is somebody who's constantly being, you know, grilled for her tips by Steve, the horologist, and the Will, the wood restorer. Yeah, it's interesting watching them chatter amongst themselves and be so, you know, sort of delighted to be in each other's company.
Yes, they seem delighted to be in each other's company, and they're so nice to each other too. All right, lovely. Are you ever coming home, or?
Oh, well, every 2 hours or so, Jim, I'm looking on the managed quarantine site to wait for November, December to open up.
Ah, you are.
Yes. yes, well, it's been a tough old time being away for the longest period I've been away for. But certainly for a short break to see my lovely mother.
Yes.
And then, you know, I mean, long term, who knows? I think the lockdown and COVID has changed a lot of people's worldviews, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Being with family is really important. So, yes, that's been particularly tough.
Well, you've developed a television triumph, so congratulations on that. It's been very nice to be able to get hold of you and have a chat to you about it all.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Carla Maria Lawson.